them. Miller's heart sped up, adrenaline leaking into his blood. But it didn't happen again. He had to find her. He had to find her soon. He could feel exhaustion grinding at him, little teeth chewing at the back of his mind. He already wasn't thinking as clearly as he should. Back on Ceres, he'd have gone back to his hole, slept for a day, and come back to the problem whole. Not an option here. Full circle. He'd come full circle. Once, in a different life, he'd taken on the risk of finding her. Then, when he'd failed, they'd been taking vengeance. And now he had the chance to find her again, to save her. And if he couldn't, he was still pulling a cheap, squeaky-wheeled wagon behind him that would do for revenge. Miller shook his head. He was having too many moments like this, getting lost in his own thoughts. He took a fresh grip on the cart full of fusion bomb, leaned forward, and headed out. The station around him creaked the way he imagined an old sailing ship might have, timbers bent by waves of salt water and the great tidal tug-of-war between Earth and Moon. Here it was stone, and Miller couldn't guess what forces were acting on it. Hopefully, nothing that would interfere with the signal between his hand terminal and his cargo. He didn't want to be reduced to his component atoms unintentionally. It was getting more and more clear that he couldn't cover the whole station. He'd known that from the start. If Julie had gotten herself someplace obscure, hidden in some niche or hole like a dying cat, he wouldn't find her. He'd become a gambler, betting against all hope on drawing the inside straight. The voice of Eros shifted. Different voices now, singing something in Hindi. A child's round. Eros harmonizing with itself in a growing richness of voices. Now that he knew to listen for it, he heard Julie's voice threading its way among the others. Maybe it had always been there. His frustration verged on physical pain. She was so close, but he couldn't quite reach her. He pulled himself back into the main corridor complex. The hospital bays had been a good place to look for her, too. Plausible. Fruitless. He'd looked at the two mercantile biolabs. Nothing. He'd tried the morgue, the police holding tanks. He'd even gone through the evidence room, bin after plastic bin of contraband drugs and confiscated weapons scattered on the floor like oak leaves in one of the grand parks. It had all meant something, once. Each one had been part of a small human drama, waiting to be brought out into the light, part of a trial, or at least a hearing. Some small practice for Judgment Day, postponed now forever. All points were moot. Something silver flew above him, faster than a bird, and then another, and then a flock streaming by overhead. Light glittered off the living metal, bright as fish scales. Miller watched the alien molecule improvising in the space above him. "You can't stop here," Holden said. "You have to stop running and get on the right road." Miller looked over his shoulder. The captain stood, real and not, where his inner Julie would have been. "Well, that's interesting," Miller thought. "I know," he said. "It's just, I don't know where she went. And, well, look around. Big place, you know. You can stop her, or I will," his imaginary Holden said. "If I just knew where she went," Miller said. "She didn't," Holden said. "She never went." Miller turned to look at him. The swarm of silver roiled overhead, chittering like insects or a badly tuned drive. The captain looked tired. Miller's imagination had put a surprising swath of blood at the corner of the man's mouth. And then it wasn't Holden anymore. It was Havelock, the other Earther, his old partner. And then it was Muss, her eyes as dead as his own. Julie didn't go anyplace. Miller had seen her in the hotel room, back when he still hadn't believed that anything but a bad smell could rise from the grave. Back before. She'd been taken away in a body bag, and then taken somewhere else. The Protogen scientists had recovered her, harvested the protomolecule, and spread Julie's remade flesh through the station, like bees pollinating a field of wildflowers. They'd given her the station, but before they'd done it, they'd put her someplace they thought they would be safe. Safe room. Until they were ready to distribute the thing, they'd want to contain it. To pretend it could be contained. It wasn't likely they'd have gone to the trouble of cleaning up after they had gotten what they needed. It wasn't as if anyone else was going to be around to use the space, so chances were good she was still there. That narrowed things. There would be isolation wards in the hospital, but Protogen wouldn't have been likely to use facilities where non-Protogen doctors and nurses might wonder what was happening. Unnecessary risk. All right. They could have set up in one of the manufacturing plants down by the port. There were plenty of places there that required all Waldo work. But again, it would have been at the risk of being discovered or questioned before the trap was ready to spring. "It's a drug house," Muss said in his mind. "You want privacy? You want control? Extracting the bug from the dead girl and extracting the good shit from the poppy seeds might have different chemistry, but it's still crime." "Good point," Miller said. "And near the casino level..." "No, that's not right. The casino was the second stage. The first was the radiation scare. They put a bunch of people in the radiation shelters and cooked them to get the protomolecule good and happy. Then they infected the casino level." "So where would you put a drug kitchen that was close to the rad shelters?" Muss asked. The roiling silver stream overhead veered left and then right, pouring through the air. Tiny curls of metal began to rain down, drawing thin trails of smoke behind them as they did. "If I had the access, the backup environment controls. It's an emergency facility. No foot traffic unless someone's running inventory. It's got all the equipment for isolation built in already. Wouldn't be hard. And since Protogen ran Eros security even before they put the disposable thugs in place, they'd be able to arrange it," Muss said, and she smiled joylessly. "See? I knew you could think that through." For less than a second, Muss was gone, and Julie Mao, his Julie, was in her place. She was smiling and beautiful, radiant. Her hair floated around her as if she were swimming in zero-G. And then she was gone. His suit alarm warned him about an increasingly corrosive environment. "Hang tight," he said to the burning air. "I'll be right there." It was just less than 33 hours from the moment he'd realized that Juliet Andromeda Mao wasn't dead to the one when he cycled down the energy seals and pulled his cart into Eros's backup environmental control facility. The clean, simple lines and error-reducing design of the place still showed under the outgrowth of the protomolecule. Barely. Knots of dark filament and nautilus spirals softened the corners of the wall and floor and ceiling. Loops hung from the ceiling like Spanish moss. The familiar LED lights still shone under the soft growth, but more illumination came from the swarm of faint blue dots glowing in the air. His first step onto the floor sank him into a thick carpet up the ankle. The bomb cart would have to stay outside. His suit reported a wild mix of exotic gases and aromatic molecules, but all he smelled was himself. All the interior rooms had been remade, transformed. He walked through the wastewater treatment control areas like a scuba diver in a grotto. The blue lights swirled around him as he passed, a few dozen adhering to his suit and glittering there. He almost didn't brush them off the helmet's faceplate, thinking they would smear like dead fireflies, but they only swirled back up into the air. The air recycling monitors still danced and glowed, the thousand alarms and incident reports silhouetting the latticework of protomolecule that covered the screens. Water was flowing somewhere close by. She was in a hazmat analysis node, lying on a bed of the dark thread that spilled out from her spine until it was indistinguishable from a massive fairy tale cushion of her own flowing hair. Tiny points of blue light glittered on her face, her arms, her breasts. The bone spurs that had been pressing out of her skin had grown into sweeping, almost architectural connections with the lushness around her. Her legs were gone, lost in the tangle of dark alien webs. She reminded Miller of a mermaid who had traded her fins for a space station. Her eyes were closed, but he could see them shifting and dancing under the lids, and she was breathing. Miller stood beside her. She didn't have quite the same face as his imagined Julie. The real woman was wider through the jaw, and her nose wasn't as straight as he remembered it. He didn't notice that he was weeping until he tried to wipe the tears away, batting his helmet with a gloved hand. He had to make do with blinking hard until his sight cleared. All this time, all this way, and here was what he'd come for. "Julie," he said, putting his free hand on her shoulder. "Hey, Julie, wake up. I need you to wake up now." He had his suit's medical supplies. If he needed to, he could dose her with adrenaline or amphetamines. Instead, he rocked her gently, like he had Candace on a sleepy Sunday morning, back when she'd still been his wife, back in some distant, near-forgotten lifetime. Julie frowned, opened her mouth, closed it. "Julie, you need to wake up now." She moaned and lifted an ineffectual arm to push him away. "Come back to me," he said. "You need to come back now." Her eyes opened. They weren't human anymore. The sclera etched with swirls of red and black, the iris the same luminous blue as the fireflies. Not human, but still Julie. Her lips moved soundlessly, and then, "Where am I?" "Eros Station," Miller said. "The place isn't what it used to be. Not even where it used to be, but..." He pressed the bed of filament with his hand, judging it, and then rested his hip at her side like he was sitting on her bed. His body felt achingly tired, and also lighter than it should. Not like low gravity. The unreal buoyancy had nothing to do with the weary flesh. Julie tried to talk again, struggled, stopped, tried again.
"Who are you?"
"Yeah, we haven't officially met, have we? My name's Miller. I used to be a detective for Star Helix Security back on Ceres. Your parents contracted with us. Only it was really more a friends in high places thing. I was supposed to track you down, grab you, ship you back down the well. Kidnap job? She said. Her voice was stronger. Her gaze seemed more focused. Pretty standard, Miller said, then sighed. I kind of cocked it up, though. Her eyes fluttered closed, but she kept talking. Something happened to me. Yeah, it did. I'm scared. No, don't be scared. It's all right. In an ass, backward kind of way, but it's all right. Look, right now the whole station is heading back for Earth. Really fast. I dreamed I was racing. I was going home. Yeah. We need to stop that. Her eyes opened again. She looked lost, anguished, alone. A tear streaked down from the corner of her eye, glowing blue. Give me your hand, Miller said. No, really, I need you to hold something for me. She lifted her hand slowly, seaweed in a soft current. He took his hand terminal, settled it in her palm, pressed her thumb to the dead man's switch. Just hold that there. Don't let it up. What is it? She asked. Long story. Just don't let up. His suit alarms shrieked at him when he undid his helmet seals. He turned them off. The air was strange, acetate and cumin, and a deep, powerful musk that made him think of hibernating animals. Julie watched him as he stripped off his gloves. Right then, the protomolecule was latching on to him, burrowing into his skin and eyes, getting ready to do to him what it had done to everyone on Eros. He didn't care. He took the hand terminal back and then laced his fingers through hers. You're driving this bus, Julie, he said. Do you know that? I mean, can you tell? Her fingers were cool in his, but not cold. I can feel something, she said. I'm hungry? Not hungry, but I want something. I want to go back to Earth. We can't do that. I need you to change course, Miller replied. What had Holden said? Give her Venus. Head for Venus instead. That's not what it wants, she said. It's what we've got on offer, Miller said. Then a moment later, we can't go home. We need to go to Venus. She was quiet for a long moment. You're a fighter, Julie. You've never let anyone call your shots for you. Don't start now. If we go to Earth, it'll eat them too. The same way it ate me. Yeah. She looked up at him. Yeah, he said again. Like that. What happens on Venus? We die, maybe. I don't know. But we don't take a lot of people with us, and we make sure no one gets a hold of this crap, he said, gesturing at the grotto around them. And if we don't die, then, well, that'll be interesting. I don't think I can. You can. The thing that's doing all this, you're smarter than it is. You're in control. Take us to Venus. The fireflies swirled around them, the blue light pulsing slightly, bright and dim, bright and dim. Miller saw it in her face when she made the decision. All around them, the lights went bright, the grotto flooding in soft blue, and then dimmed back to where they had been before. Miller felt something catch at the back of his neck, like the first warning of a sore throat. He wondered if he'd have time to deactivate the bomb. And then he looked at Julie. Juliet Andromeda Mao, OPA pilot, heir to the Mao-Kwiatkowski corporate throne. The seed crystal of a future beyond anything he'd ever dreamed. He'd have plenty of time.
"I'm afraid," she said.
"Don't be," he said.
"I don't know what's going to happen," she said.
"No one ever does. And look, you don't have to do this alone," he said.
"I can feel something in the back of my mind. It wants something I don't understand. It's so big."
Reflexively, he kissed the back of her hand. There was an ache starting deep in his belly, a sense of illness, a moment's nausea, the first pangs of his transformation into Eros. "Don't worry," he said. "We're gonna be fine." Chapter 55. Holden. Holden dreamed. He'd been a lucid dreamer most of his life. So when he found himself sitting in his parents' kitchen in the old house in Montana, talking to Naomi, he knew. He couldn't quite understand what she was saying, but she kept pushing her hair out of her eyes as she munched cookies and drank tea. And while he found that he wasn't ever able to pick a cookie up and take a bite out of it, he could smell them, and the memory of Mother Elise's chocolate chip oatmeal cookies was a very good one. It was a good dream. The kitchen strobed red once, and something changed. Holden felt the wrongness of it, felt the dream slipping from warm memory into nightmare. He tried to say something to Naomi, but couldn't form the words. The room strobed red again, but she didn't seem to notice. He got up and went to the kitchen window and looked out. When the room strobed a third time, he saw what was causing it. Meteors were falling out of the sky, leaving behind them fiery trails the color of blood. He somehow knew they were chunks of Eros as it crashed through the atmosphere. Miller had failed. The nuclear attack had failed. Julie had come home. He turned around to tell Naomi to run, but black tendrils had burst through the floor and wrapped her up, pierced her body in multiple places. They poured from her mouth and eyes. Holden tried to run to her, to help her, but he couldn't move. And when he looked down, he saw that the tendrils had come up and grabbed him, too. One wrapped around his waist and held him. Another pressed into his mouth. He woke with a yell in a dark room that was strobing with red light. Something was holding him around the waist. In a panic, he began clawing at it, threatening to tear a fingernail loose on his left hand, before his rational mind reminded him where he was. On the ops deck, in his chair, belted down in zero-G. He popped his finger into his mouth, trying to soothe the abused fingertip he'd damaged on one of the chair buckles, and took a few deep breaths through his nose. The deck was empty. Naomi was asleep down in her cabin. Alex and Amos were off duty and presumably sleeping too. They'd spent almost 2 days without rest during the high-G chase of Eros. Holden had ordered everyone to get some shut-eye and had volunteered to take first watch, and then had promptly fallen asleep. Not good. The room flashed red again. Holden shook his head to clear the last of the sleep away and refocused his attention on his console. A red warning light pulsed. and he tapped the screen to open up the menu. It was his threat panel. Someone was hitting them with a targeting laser. He opened up the threat display and turned on the active sensors. The only ship within millions of kilometers was the Ravi, and it was the ship that was targeting them. According to the automatic logs, it had just started a few seconds earlier. He reached out to activate the comm and call the Ravi as his incoming message light flickered on. He opened the connection, and a second later, McBride's voice said, "Rocinante, cease maneuvering. Open your outer airlock door and prepare to be boarded." Holden frowned at his console. Was that a weird joke? "McBride, this is Holden. What?" Her reply was in a clipped tone that was not encouraging. "Holden, open your outer airlock and prepare for boarding. If I see a single defensive system wake up, I will fire on your ship. Is that understood?" "No," he said, not quite able to keep the annoyance out of his voice. "It's not understood. And I'm not going to let you board me. What the hell is going on?" "I've been ordered by UNN command to take control of your vessel. You're charged with interfering with UNN military operations, unlawfully commandeering UNN military assets, and a list of other crimes I'm not going to bother reading right now. If you do not surrender immediately, we will be forced to fire on you." "Oh," said Holden. The UNN had discovered that their missiles were changing course, had attempted to reprogram them, and had discovered that the missiles weren't listening. They were upset. "McBride," Holden said after a moment, "boarding us won't do any good. We can't give you those missiles back. And it's unnecessary anyway. They're just taking a little detour." McBride's laugh sounded more like the sharp bark of an angry dog just before it bit. "Detour," she said. "You handed 3,573 high-yield thermonuclear interplanetary ballistic missiles over to a traitor and accused war criminal." It took Holden a minute. "You mean Fred?" "I think traitor is a bit harsh," McBride cut in. "Deactivate the false transponders leading our missiles away from Eros and reactivate the transponders on the surface, or we will fire on your ship. You have 10 minutes to comply." The connection dropped with a click. Holden looked at the console with something between disbelief and outrage, then shrugged and hit the battle station's alarm. Deck lights came on all over the ship in an angry red. The warning klaxon sounded 3 times. In less than 2 minutes, Alex rushed up the ladder to the cockpit, and half a minute behind him, Naomi threw herself into her op station. Alex spoke first. "The Ravi is 400 kilometers away," he said. "Ladar says her tube is open and she's got us locked." Clearly enunciating his words, Holden said, "Do not, I repeat, do not open our tubes or attempt to get a target lock on the Ravi at this time. Just keep a close eye on her and prepare to go defensive if she looks like she's firing. Let's not do anything to provoke her." "Shall I begin jamming?" Naomi said from behind him. "No, that would look aggressive. But prep a countermeasures package and have your finger on the ready button," Holden said. "Amos, you in engineering?"
"Roger that, Cap. Ready to go down here."
"Bring the reactor up to 100% and pull control and the point defense cannons to your console down there. If they start shooting at us at this range, Alex won't have time to fly and shoot back. You see a red dot on the threat console, you open up with the PDCs immediately. Copy?"
"Roger that," Amos said.
Holden blew a long breath through his teeth, then opened the channel to the Ravi again. "McBride, this is Holden. We are not surrendering, we are not going to let you board us, and we aren't going to comply with your demands. Where do we go from here?" "Holden," McBride said, "your reactor is coming up. Are you getting ready to fight with us?"
"No, just getting ready to try and survive."
"Why are we fighting?" Another short, harsh laugh. "Holden," McBride said, "why do I get the feeling you aren't taking this seriously?"
"Oh, I absolutely am," Holden replied. I don't want you to kill me, and believe it or not, I have no desire to kill you. The nukes are on a little detour, but this isn't something we need to go down in flames over. I can't give you what you want, and I'm not interested in spending the next 30 years in a military prison. You gain nothing by shooting us, and I will fight back if it comes to that. McBride cut the channel.
Captain, Alex said, the Robbie's starting to maneuver. She's spraying clutter. I think she's getting ready to make an attack run.
Shit. Holden had been so sure he could talk her out of it.
Okay, go defensive. Naomi, start your countermeasures. Amos, got your finger on that button?
Ready,
Amos replied.
Don't hit it until you see a missile launch. Don't want to force their hand.
Sudden crushing G's hit Holden, stuffing him into his chair. Alex had started maneuvering.
At this distance, maybe I can out-turn her, keep her from being able to take a shot, the pilot said.
Do it, and open the tubes.
Roger,
Alex said, his professional pilot's calm not quite able to keep the excitement about a possible battle out of his voice.
I've broken the targeting lock, Naomi said. Their laser array is not nearly as good as the Rossi's. I'm just drowning it in clutter.
Hooray for bloated Martian defense budgets, Holden replied.
The ship jerked suddenly through a series of wild maneuvers.
Damn,
Alex said, his voice strained by the G-force of the sharp turns.
The Robbie just opened up on us with her PDCs.
Holden checked his threat display and saw the long, glowing pearl strands of incoming rounds displayed there. The shots were falling well behind them. The Rossi reported the distance between the ships as 370 kilometers. Pretty long range for computer targeting systems to hit a wildly maneuvering ship with a ballistic shot from another wildly maneuvering ship.
Return fire?
Amos yelled into the comm.
No!
Holden yelled back.
If she wanted us dead, she'd be throwing torpedoes. Don't give her a reason to want us dead.
Cap, we're out-turning her, Alex said. The Rossi's just too fast. We'll have a firing solution in less than a minute.
Roger, Holden said.
Do I take the shot?
Alex asked, his silly Martian cowboy accent fading as his tension rose.
No.
Their targeting laser just shut off, Naomi said.
Which means they've given up trying to cut our jamming,
Holden replied, and have just switched their missiles over to radar tracking.
Not as accurate, Naomi said hopefully.
A corvette like that carries at least a dozen fish. They only need to hit us with one to make us dead, and at this range...
A gentle sound came from his threat console, letting him know that the Rossi had calculated a firing solution to the Ravi.
I've got tone!
Alex yelled.
Fire?
No,
Holden said. He knew that inside the Ravi, they were getting the loud warning buzz of an enemy lock.
Stop, Holden willed them. Please don't make me kill you.
Oh,
Alex said in a low voice.
Huh.
Behind Holden, at almost the same moment, Naomi said,
Jim?
Before he could ask, Alex came back on the general comm.
Hey, Captain. Eros just came back.
What?
Holden said, a brief image of the asteroid sneaking up like a cartoon villain on the two circling warships popping into his head.
Yeah,
Alex said.
Eros. It just popped back up on radar. Whatever it was doing to block our sensors... It just stopped doing it.
What's it doing? Holden said. Get me a course.
Naomi pulled the tracking information to her console and began working on it, but Alex was done a few seconds sooner.
Yeah, he said. Good guess. It's changing course. Still heading sunward, but deflecting away from the Earth vector it was on.
If it keeps this course and speed, Naomi chimed in, I'd say it was heading toward Venus.
Wow, said Holden. That was a joke.
Good joke, Naomi said.
Well, someone tell McBride
She doesn't need to shoot us now.
Hey,
Alex said, his voice thoughtful.
If we made those nukes stop listening, that means we can't shut them down, right? Wonder where Fred's gonna drop those.
Hell of fine, though, Amos said. Just disarmed Earth, though. That's gotta be fucking embarrassing.
Unintended consequences, Naomi sighed. Always with the unintended consequences.
Eros crashing into Venus was the most widely broadcast and recorded event in history. By the time the asteroid reached the sun's second planet, several hundred ships had taken up orbits there. Military vessels tried to keep the civilian ships away, but it was no use. They were just outnumbered. The video of Eros's descent was captured by military gun cameras, civilian ship telescopes, and the observatories on two planets and five moons. Holden wished he could have been there to see it up close. But Eros had picked up speed after it had turned, almost as though the asteroid were impatient for the journey to end now that the destination was in sight. He and the crew sat in the galley of the Rosinante and watched it on the broadcast news feeds. Amos had dug up yet another bottle of faux tequila from somewhere and was liberally splashing it into coffee cups. Alex had them flying toward Tycho at a gentle 1/3 G. No need to hurry now. It was all over, but the fireworks. Holden reached out, took Naomi's hand, and held it tightly as the asteroid entered Venus orbit, and then seemed to stop. He felt like he could feel the entire human race holding their breath. No one knew what Eros, no, what Julie, would do now. No one had spoken to Miller after the last time Holden had, and he wasn't answering his hand terminal. No one knew for sure what had happened on the asteroid. When the end came, it was beautiful. In orbit around Venus, Eros came apart like a puzzle box. The giant asteroid split into a dozen chunks, stringing out around the equator of the planet in a long necklace. Then, those dozen pieces split into a dozen more, and then a dozen after that. A glittering fractal seed cloud spreading out across the entire surface of the planet, disappearing into the thick cloud layer that usually hid Venus from view.
Wow,
Amos said, his voice almost reverent. That was gorgeous, Naomi said, vaguely unsettling, but gorgeous.
They won't stay there forever, Holden said.
Alex tossed off the last of the tequila in his glass, then refilled it from the bottle.
What do you mean, Cap? He asked.
Well, I'm just guessing, but I doubt the things that built the protomolecule just wanted to store it here. This was part of a bigger plan. We saved the Earth, Mars, the Belt. Question is, what happens now? Naomi and Alex exchanged glances. Amos pursed his lips. On screen, Venus glittered as arcs of lightning danced all across the planet.
Cap, Amos said, you are seriously harshing my buzz.
Epilogue. Fred. Frederick Lucius Johnson, former colonel in Earth's armed forces, butcher of Anderson Station. Thoth Station now, too. Unelected prime minister of the OPA. He had faced his own mortality a dozen times, lost friends to violence and politics and betrayal. He'd lived through four assassination attempts, only two of which were on any record. He'd killed a pistol-wielding attacker using only a table knife. He'd given the orders that had ended hundreds of lives, and stood by his decisions. And yet, public speaking still made him nervous as hell. It didn't make sense, but there it was.
Ladies and gentlemen, we stand at a crossroads.
General Sebastian will be at the reception, his personal secretary said. Remember not to ask after her husband.
Why? I didn't kill him, did I?
No, sir. He's having a very public affair, and the general's a bit touchy about it.
So, she might want me to kill him.
You can make the offer, sir. The green room was actually done in red and ochre, with a black leather couch, a mirrored wall, and a table laid out with hydroponic strawberries and carefully mineralized drinking water. The head of Ceres Security, a dour-faced woman named Shadid, had escorted him from the dock to the conference facilities 3 hours earlier. Since then, he'd been pacing. 3 steps in one direction, turn, 3 steps back, like the captain of an ancient ship of the line on his quarterdeck. Elsewhere in the station, the representatives of the formerly warring factions were in rooms of their own, with secretaries of their own. Most of them hated Fred, which wasn't particularly a problem. Most of them feared him, too. Not because of his standing in the OPA, of course. Because of the protomolecule. The political rift between Earth and Mars was probably irreparable. The Earth forces loyal to Protogen had engineered a betrayal too deep for apologies, and too many lives had been lost on both sides for the coming peace to look anything like it had been before. The naive among the OPA thought this was a good thing, an opportunity to play one planet against the other. Fred knew better. Unless all 3 forces, Earth, Mars, and the Belt, could reach a real peace, they would inevitably fall back into real war. Now, if only Earth or Mars thought of the Belt as something more than an annoyance to be squashed after their true enemy was humiliated. But, in truth, anti-Mars sentiment on Earth was higher now than it had been during the shooting war, and Martian elections were only 4 months away. A significant shift in Martian polity could ease the tensions, or make things immeasurably worse. Both sides had to see the big picture. Fred stopped before a mirror, adjusted his tunic for the 100th time, and grimaced.
"When did I turn into a damned marriage counselor?" he said.
"We aren't still talking about General Sebastian, are we, sir?"
"No. Forget I said anything. What else do I need to know?"
"There's a possibility that Blue Mars will try to disrupt your presentation. Hecklers and signs, not guns. Captain Shadid has several Blues in custody, but some may have slipped past her."
"All right.
You have interviews scheduled with 2 political narrowcasts and a news source based on Europa. The Europa interviewer is likely to ask about Anderson Station."
"All right. Anything new from Venus?"
"Something's happening down there," his secretary said.
"It's not dead, then?"
"Apparently not, sir."
"Great," he said bitterly. "Ladies and gentlemen, we stand at a crossroads. On one hand, there is the very real threat of mutual annihilation. And, on the other, there's the boogeyman of Venus, getting ready to crawl up out of its well and slaughter you all in your sleep. I have the live sample, which is your best, if not only, hope of divining what its intentions and capabilities are, and which I have hidden so that you can't just march over and take it from me. It's the only reason any of you are listening to me in the first place. So,
How about a little respect here? His secretary's terminal chirped, and she consulted it briefly. It's Captain Holden, sir.
Do I have to?
It would be best if he felt he was part of the effort, sir. He has a track record of amateur press releases.
Fine. Bring him in.
The weeks that had passed since Eros Station had come apart in the thick skies of Venus had been good to Holden. But prolonged high-G dives like the one the Rosinante had sustained chasing Eros had long-lasting effects. The burst blood vessels in the man's sclera had healed. The pressure bruising had gone from around his eyes and the back of his neck. Only a little hesitation in the way he walked spoke of the deep joint pain. Cartilage still on its way back to its natural form. Acceleration swagger, they'd called it. Back when Fred had been a different man.
Hey, Holden said. You're looking pretty. Did you see the latest feed from Venus?
2-kilometer-high crystal towers. What do you think that is?
Your fault? Fred suggested, keeping the tone friendly. You could have told Miller to drive it into the sun.
Yes, because 2-kilometer-high crystal towers coming out of the sun wouldn't be creepy at all, Holden said.
Are those strawberries?
Have some, Fred said. He hadn't been able to eat anything since that morning.
So, Holden said, around a mouthful of fruit, are they really going to sue me over this?
Unilaterally giving away all mineral and development rights to an entire planet on an open radio channel?
Yeah, Holden said.
I would guess the people who actually own those rights are probably going to sue you, Fred said, if they ever figure out who they are.
Could you give me a hand with that? Holden asked.
I'll be a character witness, Fred said. I don't actually make the law.
Then what exactly are you all doing here?
Couldn't there be some kind of amnesty?
We retrieved the protomolecule, tracked down Julie Mao on Eros, broke Protogen, and saved Earth.
You saved Earth?
We helped, Holden said. But his voice had a more somber tone. Miller's death still bothered the captain. Fred knew how that felt. It was a joint effort.
Fred's personal secretary cleared her throat and glanced toward the door. They'd need to go soon.
I'll do what I can, Fred said. I've got a lot of other things on the plate, but I'll do what I can.
And Mars can't have the Rosie back, Holden said. Ride of Salvage says that's my ship now.
They aren't going to see it that way. But I will do what I can.
You keep saying that.
It keeps being all I can do.
And you'll tell them about him, right? Holden said. Miller. He deserves the credit.
The belter who went back into Eros of his own free will in order to save Earth? You're damn right I'm going to tell them about him.
Not the belter. Him. Josephus Aloysius Miller. Holden had stopped eating the free strawberries. Fred crossed his arms.
You've been reading up, Fred said.
Yeah, well, I didn't know him all that well.
Neither did anybody else, Fred said,
and then softened a little.
I know it's hard. But we don't need a real man with a complex life. We need a symbol of the belt, an icon.
Sir, the secretary said, we really do need to go now.
That's what got us here, Holden said. Icons, symbols, people without names. All of those Protogen scientists were thinking about biomass and populations, not Mary, who worked in supply and raised flowers in her spare time. None of them killed her.
You think they wouldn't have?
I think if they were going to, they owed it to her to know her name. All their names.
And you owe it to Miller not to make him into something he wasn't. Fred laughed. He couldn't help it.
Captain, he said, if you're saying that I should amend my address to the peace conference so that it wasn't a noble belter sacrificing himself to save the Earth, if you're suggesting that I say something like we happen to have a suicidal ex-cop on site instead, you understand this process less than I thought you did. Miller's sacrifice is a tool, and I'm going to use it.
Even if it makes him faceless, Holden said. Even if it makes him something he never was?
Especially if it makes him something he never was, Fred said. Do you remember what he was like?
Holden frowned, and then something flickered in his eyes. Amusement. Memory.
He was kind of a pain in the ass, wasn't he? Holden said. That man could take a visitation from God with 30 underdressed angels announcing that sex was okay after all, and make it seem vaguely depressing.
He was a good man, Holden said.
He wasn't, Fred said, but he did his job. And now, I've got to go do mine.
Give him hell, Holden said. And amnesty. Keep talking up the amnesty. Fred walked down the curving hallway, his secretary close behind him. The conference halls had been designed for smaller things, petty ones. Hydroponic scientists getting away from their husbands and wives and children to get drunk and talk about raising bean sprouts. Miners coming together to lecture each other about waste minimization and tailings disposal. High school band competitions. And instead, these work carpets and brushed stone walls were going to have to bear the fulcrum of history. It was Holden's fault that the shabby, small surroundings reminded him of the dead detective. They hadn't before. The delegations were seated across the aisle from each other. The generals and political appointees and general secretaries of Earth and Mars, the two great powers together at his invitation to Ceres, to the Belt. Territory made neutral because neither side took it seriously enough to be concerned about their demands. All of history had brought them here to this moment. And now, in the next few minutes, Fred's job was to change that trajectory. The fear was gone. Smiling, he stepped up to the speaker's dais, the podium, the pulpit. There was a scattering of polite applause, a few smiles and a few frowns. Fred grinned. He wasn't a man anymore. He was a symbol, an icon. A narrative about himself and about the forces at play in the solar system. And for a moment, he was tempted. In that hesitation between drawing breath and speaking, part of him wondered what would happen if he shed the patterns of history and spoke about himself as a man, about the Joe Miller who he'd known briefly, about the responsibility they all shared to tear down the images they held of one another, and find the genuine, flawed, conflicted people they actually were. It would have been a noble way to fail.
Ladies and gentlemen, he said, we stand at a crossroads. On one hand, there is the very real threat of mutual annihilation. On the other, he paused for effect. On the other, the stars.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Leviathan Wakes, Book One of The Expanse. Written by James S.A. Corey. Read by Jefferson Mays. Produced by Elise Green. Directed by Pavel Rivera. Recorded by Hachette Studios. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. Leviathan Wakes is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2011 by James S. A. Corey. Audio production copyright 2017, Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.